Well, why don't we get started? I'll at least do the preliminary of explaining who I am and what I intend to do. My name is Hal Poe. I'm the Charles Colson Professor of Faith and Culture here at Union. I teach in the Christian Studies Department. And this session is going to look at general issues of tradition in translation, and then focus in on the first chapter of Genesis. I'm not dealing with all the issues there, but just a particular issue of the days, the 7 days. I don't have any pictures to show you. I've been in a session this last time that had some dazzling illustrations. I don't, because we're not going to do that, and I want to give you a chance to leave if you want to. Do you remember your 8th grade English class where you just drilled on grammar week after week after week? Well, that's what we're going to be doing for the next little while, is looking at just some basic grammar. So at one level, this lecture will be accessible to any elementary child who's gotten through the 4th grade. On the other hand, I think it is probably one of the most controversial lectures I've ever given. Might get fired. We'll see what kind of a dance I do. So let's take a look then. The King James translation, an amazing thing. I usually quote scripture in the King James. Most of the Bible I know, I memorized in the King James. But then I've been preaching for so long and using different translations, the pure text has been modified. And I'm sometimes shocked when I think I'm quoting the King James and realize I've changed a word or two here and there along the way. And so you may know what I'm talking about. I grew up at a time when the entire congregation could take out their Bible and read together aloud. And if we did that today, it would sound like the day of Pentecost. So, you know, there's something that's been lost in translation. But at the other hand, I encourage my New Testament students to bring whatever translation they have, because often we will compare translations as we discuss a text and get at what is God saying to us. And why did one translator translate it that way? Why did they choose that word? You remember Timothy George last night talking about Thomas More's criticism of Tyndale's translation. And instead of translating ecclesia as church, he translated it as congregation. And why do they make those choices? Well, I'm going to not explore those translations that were highly controversial at the time, that were charged with theological significance. Instead, I want to point out some things that have to do with what nobody even notices. Things that are so deeply a part of the tradition, you assume them without even being aware that there's an issue there to consider. And so what we'll really be looking at are things that the King James translators did not even notice or question or think about, because everybody knows that. But in fact, they were adopting a tradition that was in conflict with what the text actually said. So let's look at a couple of these. Well, we're going to look at three first very quickly. The first one is, I never could figure out how to line that up, Lord. Simple word, Lord. Have you ever looked through your Old Testament and found Lord, all four letters capitalized, capital L, capital O, capital R, capital B? And you asked your Sunday school teacher, why are all the letters capitalized? And they'll tell you what everybody knows, to show respect, right? Of course. It's not true, but that's, you know, we make it up. You don't want to be caught off guard. So we make it up. And the King James translators followed a tradition of not translating that word. They did not translate the word that is found every time you see those four letters. The word is the holy name of God, Yahweh. Yahweh. It's Hebrew works backwards, or rather English works backwards because they were doing it first, right? Okay. It reads from right to left, and here's the great thing about Hebrew, it has no vowels, just consonants. So it's not a southern dialect. We have lots of vowels, and we can stretch them out. And you want to take care of your vowels, or else they'll disappear, as they did in Hebrew, and then the language died, you see. So, care for your vowels. And the South is where our vowels are nurtured and cared for. Otherwise, English will disappear. All right, now here's the trick. In ancient times, the Jews got superstitious. Remember, they were worshiping the brass serpent in the temple, and they got superstitious about a lot of things. One of the things they got superstitious about was the name of God. Remember when God revealed his name to Moses and said, "You're going to call me by my name. We're on a first name basis. I'm Yahweh. You call me Yahweh. You call me by name. You get close." And Israel spent years pushing away. Okay? Final push away was, we're not going to say God's name anymore. It's too holy to speak. Whenever we see these letters in the text, instead of pronouncing the holy name Yahweh, we will pronounce the word Adonai, the Lord. Adonai. In the Middle Ages, the rabbis invented some little signs that are called breathing marks, all sorts of little things, little points and dashes and dots and that sort of thing. And they would strew them around these letters to show you what kind of vowel sound to make when you say a word. So when they got to the name of God, instead of putting the vowel signs for Yahweh, they put the vowel sounds for Adonai. Now, go forward now to the 19th century. Germans and English pronounce these vowels differently. Pronounce consonants differently. You remember a composer of last name of Bach? What's his first name? Johann. So that would begin with a Y? A J. Okay, so the Germans would put a J for that sound, because that makes the same sound that we have with that. And how about Mozart? Does anybody remember the first name of Mozart?
Wolfgang.
Wolfgang, exactly. So that would be a V? No, it would be a W. Okay. If you put the vowels for Adonai with the consonants for Yahweh and take it through the German scholars and read it in the United States, it comes out Jehovah, a nonsense word that never existed. And there's an entire religion that has built itself around insisting on worshiping Jehovah. All right, this is one example of the King James translators not even noticing an issue, not even thinking about it. They just followed the tradition of, instead of translating the name, just putting what had become the tradition, the letters, and in this case they used English letters and just put Lord there. So that's one example of not translating. Here's another one. Christ. We're so used to talking about Christ. This is a Greek word. Again, it's one they didn't bother to translate. Let me do away with some of these. From Greek to Latin to English, without translating, Christ is a translation from the Hebrew Messiah. And does anybody know what Messiah means?
Anointed.
The Anointed One. Okay, so why didn't they translate that so people would know what was actually being said? Well, tradition. So it's Jesus, the Anointed One, which is to say the human descendant of David who is anointed to be the king of Israel, the heir. And these two points get to be important when you get to the day of Pentecost. Acts chapter 2. And Peter is preaching the first gospel sermon. And at the conclusion of the sermon, you know, he's laid out, the prophecies have been fulfilled, Jesus has come, he's died, he's been raised, he's exalted from the right at the right hand of God, the Holy Spirit has come, and he says this. This is in chapter 2, verse 36. Therefore, I let all the house of Israel know assuredly that God hath made this same Jesus, whom ye have crucified, both Lord and Christ. That is, this is the statement that he is fully human and fully God. He is God. So whenever you hear in the New Testament, he's referred to as the Lord. A Jew of the first century, when they talked about the Lord, were not talking about somebody that they thought was important. They're talking about God. And to talk about the Christ is to talk about the human descendant of David. And Jesus is both fully human, fully divine. This is our understanding of the incarnation of who Jesus Christ is. So it's important, but it was just assumed. They'd been, you know, using the term for so long. Didn't even notice it. Wasn't an issue. Last one. Y'all are probably not all Baptists. And in the early 17th century, when they started the translation, in England there weren't any Baptists. Now there were had been a few Anabaptists on the continent. It was the one thing that the Catholics, the Lutherans, and the Calvinists could agree upon. We got to kill those people. And so they surrounded the city of Munster where they were congregated. And it was the joint army of Catholics, Calvinists, and Lutherans. Let's have peace for a while so we can get rid of these Anabaptists. So they did. But the first Baptist congregation in England wasn't started until 1609. So it was in the midst of this translation project, and they didn't translate the word baptize, which is a Greek word. it's a term they'd been using for ever, because it went from Greek into Latin and from Latin into English without ever translating it. Now, you can, in the Eastern Orthodox Church, they never stopped baptizing. There's the Greek word. They knew what the Greek word meant. The Greek word means you dunk them under. So they practice infant baptism, but they take those babies and they baptize them. They push them under the water. And so the Eastern Church continues to baptize. But that wasn't something that the translators even thought about. It was just not an issue. Didn't notice it. They assumed it. So this is the part of tradition in translation. Things you don't even think about because they've been practiced for so long, you don't notice them. Now, we've got the same situation occurring with the first chapter of Genesis. And so I want us to, we're going to key in on a couple of words, or word coupling, I should say. The days and the number or numeral associated with the day. The age of the earth has been a controversy in the West for about 200 years. And so there's a strong position of the defense of an earth that was a universe that was created in 6 solar days within 1 week time span. And then the geologists began to make statements about ancient geology. And then came the fossils. And then came the astronomy that suggested the universe has been around for a long, long time, and it took a long, long time to put together. So my concern is, what does the text actually say? Now, I'm going to throw some Hebrew at you. And you say, well, maybe I don't read Hebrew. But you can recognize digits, and that's what we're going to look at, is the digits, the text itself. And remember, Hebrew is read from right to left. So in chapter 1, verse 5, and if you have your Bible with you, whichever translation, you can look along, because whatever English translation you have, unless it is the Jewish Bible translation of 1985, your text will all say the same thing. Okay? So, the end of the God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day. The first day. Most people who discuss this talk about, well, what is the meaning of day? Is it 24 hours or is it an age? That's not an issue with me. My concern is the words that frame the word day. In the Hebrew text, it doesn't say the first day. It says one day. That's important for what went before in the text. Because you remember the Spirit of God was brooding and moving across the face of the deep. How long did that happen? Text doesn't say. But one day, God said, let there be light. Okay? Do you see the significance of that? The difference between it happening the first day and it happening one day. Let's go to verse 8. And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day. So you go Sunday, Monday, the second day. Only the Hebrew text doesn't say the second day. It says a second day. A second day. And just bear that in mind. We'll go on and begin to draw out some conclusions of what we can draw from the text itself. Verse 13. And the evening and the morning were the third day. But the Hebrew text says a third day. Now, I want to stress that in Hebrew, Hebrew is an extremely regular language. It's not like English, where there are all sorts of exceptions. It's not like Greek, which is pretty freewheeling, Koine Greek, pretty freewheeling. Hebrew is extremely regular, and normally when you have a sequence of days like the Battle of Jericho, where you go out one day and blow the trumpets and you go out the next day and you march around the city and you go out the third day and you go out the fourth day, you have the definite article. The second day, the third day. When Abraham takes his son Isaac and he journeys off to sacrifice him, you have them arriving, I think it is, on the third day. So you've got a sequence, the first day, the second day, the third day. So Hebrew does that. And in this passage, it doesn't do that. Okay? 119. And the evening and the morning were the fourth day in the King James, but in the Hebrew text, a fourth day. And down to 123. And the evening and the morning were the fifth day. But here we have a fifth day. Now, the pattern changes in verse 31. Verse 31, it's the conclusion of all this creative activity. And God saw everything that He had made, and behold, it was very good. And the evening and the morning were the sixth day in English. In Hebrew, oops, scribal error, the sixth day. Definite article. Isn't this boring? Grammar. This is the hard work of reading the Bible. You have to slow down. And we tend to be in a hurry. If you're going to read the Bible, slow down. Okay, sixth day. Then you go into chapter 2 and verse 2. And on the seventh day, God ended His work which He had made, and He rested on the seventh day from all His work which He had made. Notice the definite article in both places. The seventh day, He ended. The seventh day, He rested. And in the Hebrew text, both of those are the seventh day with the definite article. Okay, let's not draw any conclusions yet. Let's look at what the tradition has been since then. Okay, day 1 through 5, indefinite. Day 6 and day 7, definite. You with me? Any questions? Just laying out the text, basic text. Okay, just a few comments. This little digit here, that, oops, sorry, there. That letter with the line under it is the definite article that we translate the. Okay? Hebrew words tend to be short. All verbs are three letters. And the nouns are based on the verbs. And you add a couple of letters at the end to make a noun out of a verb. But the whole language is built around action. Okay? And I've just given an example here of using the definite article. And it came to pass on the third day, when it was morning, that there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mount, and the voice of a horn exceeding loud, and all the people that were in the camp trembled. That's Exodus 19:16. And notice, here is that definite article. Here's the same third from Genesis 1 without the definite article. You can't read it, but you can see they're exactly alike except for the absence of that definite article. Okay? So, in Hebrew, there's a way you specify a particular day. Now, Israel was conquered by Babylon. The temple was destroyed. The leaders carried off into captivity to the great city of Babylon. People were scattered. Some went down to Egypt. You remember Jeremiah saying, don't go down to Egypt, but they went anyway. The Persians came along and conquered the Babylonians, and they went as far as Egypt and conquered Egypt as well. And along came Alexander the Great. This is the prophecy of Daniel 7, the four great empires. So the third great empire was Alexander's empire. And under Alexander, the Greek language became the common language of commerce all over the world. And just like today, English has become that language. Mary Ann and I are going to teach at the Baptist Seminary in Singapore during October and November. And we have had to master the language there in Asia to be able to lecture. Fortunately, the language is English. And it's because Singapore is a third Chinese, a third Malay, and a third Indian. And what language are they going to use? Well, the language of Queen Victoria, of course. The same decision that the country of India made. India, a billion people with 3,000 dialects. What language are they going to use? Well, we'll either kill ourselves deciding, or we'll use English. And so, in the same way, Greek became the language of Alexander's empire, and by the first century, it was the language of commerce of the Roman Empire. And in that setting, in about the 3rd century B.C., the Jews living down in Egypt hadn't used Hebrew for such a long time. They really, most people weren't able to read the Hebrew scriptures. So they translated it into Greek. It's known as the Septuagint. And it's usually indicated by these Roman numerals, LXX, 70. Septuagint is a word that means the 70. There were, by tradition, 70 translators who went to work in the translation of the Septuagint. But again, that's one of those traditions. There might have been 72, and there might have been 147. I mean, it's one of those traditions. All right, so here's the text that was used in Palestine during the day of Jesus. You remember Jesus hanging on the cross, and he cries out, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which is Hebrew, from the Psalms, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? But you remember the crowd says he's crying out for Elijah. Did you ever wonder, why did they think that? He didn't say anything about Elijah. The crowd doesn't understand Hebrew. First century Palestinians didn't know Hebrew. The citizens of Jerusalem didn't know Hebrew. The priests would have, but the rabbis were using the Septuagint. And here is Jesus on the cross speaking the language of the Hebrew text, and the crowd doesn't understand him. They know the Septuagint, but as soon as they hear the word Eli, Eli, that sounds like Elijah, Elijah, so they don't know what's going on. Well, let's see how they translated the Hebrew text into Greek. That first passage is not the first day, it's one day. So there you have Septuagint following the text. Verse 1:8. Day second. It's not the second day, it's a second day. And 1:13. Day third. Greek can say the third day, but it doesn't. It's following the Hebrew text. And it does that all the way down to 131, where the Hebrew text had the sixth day. Remember, on the sixth day, they introduce in Hebrew the definite article, the sixth day. But here, the rabbis did not include the definite article. Why? That's peculiar. It's very peculiar to me. And I thought, what? Why didn't they do that? Well, let's look and see what they did in chapter 2, verse 2. Now, let me read it to you from the King James. And on the seventh day, God ended his work which he had made, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had made. And what the rabbis are now going to do is a bit of interpretation. And they take the definite article out of verse 31, and they put it in 2:2, and they say this: and on the day, the sixth, God ended his work. And they're doing a theology here. They're making a logical statement. They're saying, well, he didn't end his work on the seventh day, the way the Hebrew text says it. He ended his work on the sixth day, and he rested on the seventh day. Now, what's going on here? You're moving from, oops, what happened there? Did it come back on? Okay, sorry about that. You're moving from one culture to another. Hebrew culture, which doesn't have the same interest in time that Greek culture has. And remember, the Greek day begins in the morning with the sun rising, and it ends when the sun dies, because the Greeks have this idea of the god bringing the sun across the sky, and then the day dies. We still have those songs, "The day is dying in the west." Not so the Hebrews. The Hebrew understanding of the day is it begins in darkness, and God calls forth the light every day. He didn't just call forth the light one day. He calls forth the light every day. Now, I'm going to come back to that in a little bit, because this is more grammar. It's verbs. We're just doing definite articles now. We're going to do verbs in a few minutes, okay? Sorry about that. So there's the Septuagint. Following the sense of the Hebrew text, but making that change, and it's theologically driven. You see that? Translations that have been made in our country in the last 20 years are theologically driven, and they will change the meaning of the text to fit a theological understanding. Liberals do it. Conservatives do it. Do I like it? No. But I'm a curmudgeon. Okay? All right. So that's a few centuries before the birth of Christ, the Septuagint. Christ is born in Bethlehem. He dies for our sins on Golgotha's cross. He rises from the dead, is exalted to the right hand of God, sends his Holy Spirit to his people, and we get the New Testament. Okay? Go forward a few centuries to about the year 400. The empire is fading. Thank you. The empire is fading. People don't know Greek anymore. The learning has shifted to the east. Barbarians are at the door. A lot of folks don't know Greek. They know Latin. And the Bishop of Rome commissions Jerome, I believe Dr. George said Jerem. Well, he can say Jerem. I'm a Christian. No, I'm a Baptist. Okay. Either Jerome or Jerem translated the Bible into Latin, And this became the Catholic text until Vatican II in the 1960s, when Pope John the 23rd brought about this incredible reform of the church and the new translation of the scriptures, the Jerusalem Bible, into the English vernacular. Well, anyway, this was standard for centuries. So how do they translate it? Well, now, interesting thing about Latin, whereas there's a definite article in Hebrew, you can say the first day. There's a definite article in Greek, you can say the first day. There is no definite article in Latin. You cannot say the first day. It's impossible to do. There's no definite article. Some languages don't have it. Russian does not have a definite article. If you've ever listened to the movies, the spy movies, and a Russian is speaking English, and you think they talk funny because they don't use definite articles. Well, in Russian, they don't. Okay? Latin's the same way. So, with Latin, it's day one, day second, day third, day fourth, day fifth, day sixth, day seventh. And there's no differentiation between the definite article in Hebrew and on the seventh day or the absence of it on the fourth day. It's all the same. Now that's creating a mindset over 1,000 years of time of the sameness. Then let's get to Wycliffe. With Wycliffe, we find the great change. Now, he didn't invent it. He had influences. I appreciate Dr. Scott Hewlin pointing me toward Hugh St. Victor as a possible source for Wycliffe's understanding of how he's going to interpret the scriptures here. But there was also an Anglo-Saxon tradition a bit earlier around the before the Norman conquest in 1066, there was an Old English version of the book of Genesis. So there's a tradition here, and the tradition is now going to be different. So it, instead of the first day, it's a day, but then it's the second day. And Wycliffe introduces the definite article there. The third, the third day, the fourth day, the fifth day, the sixth day, and in the seventh day. And so there's your Middle English, Chaucerian English. And that's the beginning of the shift. And this will be the tradition that the King James Bible follows. This was the tradition they were familiar with. And so you'll find Tyndale doing the same thing. Tyndale talks of the first day, the second day, the third day, the fourth day, the fifth day, the sixth day. And I couldn't find the right characters to do this, but there is a letter that no longer exists in English that used to exist that is the sound TH. And it looks sort of like a P, with a long leg that goes up straight. It's called I believe that's a thorn. In the seventh day. So there's Tyndale and Coverdale. Coverdale was a contemporary of Tyndale. We've already heard about both of them. Y'all know them intimately now. And then that brings us to the King James, 1611. So you see, this tradition of shifting from the timelessness of Hebrew to a time context which had begun to dominate as we enter the modern era. And this is coterminous with the beginning of the scientific revolution. And to do science, you have to measure time. You have to make specific measurements. And so the Bible was being brought into sync with a new kind of worldview in which you think of it in that context. Now, I mentioned the Jewish Study Bible. This is the only translation I can find. I'm happy to be pointed to another one, but I've been poring over these for years, trying to. Every time a new translation is announced, I say, at last! But no, they stick with the tradition. But the Jewish Study Bible has gone back to the Hebrew, and so their translation is a first day. It really ought to be one day. But they pick up a second day, a third day, a fourth day, a fifth day, a sixth day, the sixth day, and on the seventh day. So they're reflecting the text there. Well, let's think through the implications of this way of talking about days, and I'll do it in my own life. One day, I was born. A second day, I started preaching. A third day, I started being married to Marianne Whitten. A fourth day, I started being a father to Rebecca and then to Mary Ellen. A fifth day, I started being a Jacksonian. The sixth day, I started work at Union. Notice the shift from a fifth day, I started being a Jacksonian. It's the day we unloaded the truck. And the sixth day, the very next day, I started working at Union. The seventh day, I die. Okay, now notice the time is not scientific time. It's not measured time. The emphasis in the Hebrew mind was the quality of time, what's taking place, not the duration of time. I'm talking about the quality of time rather than the duration of time, which brings me to the verbs. And I'm not going to sketch all of those out because I can do this pretty quickly and you'll get the idea, and you don't want to look at all of those Hebrew sentences. In the King James, the translators use the past tense. And God said, past tense, let there be light, and past tense, there was light. Okay? Pretty straightforward. It's not what the text says because in Hebrew there is no past tense. There is no future tense. And worst of all, there is no present tense. So how do they do it? They don't. They don't bother with time tenses in Hebrew. And you think, how can that be? And we're now dealing with worldview. We're dealing with a difference of thousands of years in understanding reality. What the Hebrew verbs are built around isn't past, present, and future. It's whether or not the action is continuing or if it's completed. That's the difference. Let's go back to this. One day, I was born. That's a 1611 King James way of saying it. If I were putting it in Hebrew, I would say, one day, I began living. You see the difference? Born is static. Only my life isn't static. I have been going on ever since I started. And that's the form of the verbs in the first chapter of Genesis. So it's something like this. And then God began to say and keeps on saying, let there begin to be light and keep on being light. and he hasn't stopped saying it. Do you get that thrust? Every morning, he calls forth the day, and we know he calls forth the sun, calls forth the light, and we now know enough about the universe to know that the sun didn't go to bed. That is, he's calling forth the light every moment, everywhere. He is. The New Testament says he upholds the world by his word power. And I think only in the 20th century did we begin to realize the significance of something like that. The upholding, the sustaining of the universe. A second day I started preaching. Now I could talk about the first day I preached. It was at Earl Street Baptist Church. And I prepared my sermon and I preached it, and it took about 4 minutes. So I preached it again. That was my second point. That brought me to 8 minutes. And then I preached it a third time, and I had a 3-point sermon. But I'm still preaching. Lord willing, I'll be preaching Sunday morning out in the country here in Madison County. Okay. Ongoing activity. And so that's the thrust of all of the verbs of the days of creation in the first chapter of Genesis. He is continuing, he began and continues to say, let the waters bring forth life. He's continuing to say, let the earth bring forth life. And just like I started being a father to Rebecca, and I didn't stop that, but I started being the father to Mary Ellen too. Ongoing action. Now, there's a lot more here to talk about. Well, let me do this one just to, because I brought some props. It has to do with numbers and how the Hebrews understood things. We've got some of that in our own language. What's a couple? Two. What's a dozen? What's a score? What's a gross? What's a week? Seven. I've got ho, ho, ho. A week of dry markers here. You've got some places in the Bible where it talks about a week of years. And then it talks about a week of weeks. Some interesting little things. Because another thing, that the Hebrews didn't do big numbers. You know, you've got some of those huge numbers of hundreds of thousands. Only they didn't have that number. That is largely a translator's decision about how to express something. Because the Hebrews had big numbers like a myriad. And how much is a myriad? A myriad divided by five is...
It's a heap.
A whole bunch. Yeah. They didn't have a lot of stuff to count. They didn't do higher math. But you come to the temple, and there's the menorah, the candlestick. Okay, now, this is an old one that was my aunt's. I have no idea where she got it. But you can look on the Ark of the Triumphal Ark of Titus in Rome that was built following the Jewish War of 66 AD when the temple was destroyed and the treasures of the temple were taken to Rome. And on that Triumphal Ark of Titus is the menorah from the temple. And this is what it looks like. So this is an ancient pattern, and there are even older archaeological representations of the menorah. This is what it looks like. And notice the seven. Seven, very important number among the Jews. and about the ages of the days of creation. I have no idea how much time is discussed from the Bible. I have no idea. But there are certain patterns. And something happens on the first day, the second day, and the third day. And then God goes back to these first three things that he did, and he ornaments them on the fourth day, the fifth day, and the sixth day. So there's a relationship between what God does on the first day and the fourth day. The second day and the fifth day. The third day and the sixth day. You see that? This is, and for the Jews, this the menorah represented, yes, the week, but it also represented the God they worshiped, the one who created the heavens and the earth and everything in them. And this is the totality of it. The totality of it. I've often wondered if the very idea of it pointing upward is symbolic as well. I don't know. Just something I've wondered about. But I'm going to stop there. We've got about 10 minutes left for discussion. And this is a highly inflammatory topic. Oh, by the way, one other thing. Here's a cubit. A cubit, again, is a grouping of seven. It's seven palms. And so there's a cubit. I saw that hand first. Yes, sir?
You just finished right there with Exodus 20, verse 11. Walk us through the problem here. In 6 days, God created the heavens, earth, sea, and all that in them is. You just said it. In 6 days, God created the heavens, the earth, the sea, and all that in them is.
Yes.
Now tell me what that means.
Oh, well, that everything that exists is a result of the creation of God. Without him was nothing made. John chapter 1.
There's no significance to
7 days?
Yeah.
Okay, 6 days. Six days. Yeah.
We cannot draw 6 24-hour days from Exodus 20 verse 11.
No, because you'd be governed by the first chapter. So the first chapter doesn't indicate a sequence of 7 days within, 7 24-hour days. What you've got is the beginning one day. You do have the 6 days of creation. What you don't have is the time frame between the first day and the second day, and the third day. So you've got the 7 days. No question about that. What we don't know is the elapse of time between the days. They are non-consecutive sequential in the first chapter of Genesis.
However, the Hebrew does not forbid 7 24-hour days. It just doesn't make it clear.
Well, no, I think it does, because the to leave out the definite article is the governing thing in Hebrew. To not have the governing article is to say we're not talking about the next 24-hour period. We're talking about a different 24-hour period sometime. Yes?
I can see what you're saying about the Christian translations, being rooted to the Greek and the Latin. Why have you only been able to find one Jewish translation that uses this literal Hebrew numbering system? In other words, you cited the JPS recent in their translation, but there are lots of other Hebrew translations, I guess.
I should say that that's the only one I looked for. I just said, well, what does a Jewish text say? And so this was the first one I picked up. It's the most recent one. And so it's just the only one. I've not really explored the Jewish tradition. I do know the Jewish tradition got, during the Middle Ages, there's a tradition called the Kabbalah, which is a tradition of mysticism. It's got a dab of the occult and astrology mixed in with it. Highly symbolic. And I'm not prepared yet to say there's a relationship between the Kabbalah and Hugh St. Victor thinking in terms of a solar week. But it looks like that may be where he got it from, because he was consulting with Jewish rabbis, and that wouldn't have been the normal Jewish rabbi take. So I'm wondering if it was an influence from the Kabbalah. But that's just, at this point, that I don't hold me to that at all. Yes, sir?
Time itself is a byproduct of creation. Is it not? God does not exist in time.
Right.
Somehow he inspired the authors to put down the sequence, and then somehow people created the actual time frame.
Yes. 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 Now, the intriguing thing to me about this, if you look at what a purely secular, atheistic cosmologist might say about the origin of the universe and then the origin of life and the order and the sequence in which things happened, Genesis 1 measures up just right down the line with that, except for the one thing, the problem with the sun and the moon, them coming later. But if you go to the Hebrew text, I didn't give you the one exception. And there is an exception. You remember Jesus talking about the jot and the tittle? Not one jot and tittle is going to pass away. Remember that? Let me show you the jot and the tittle. I love this. The Hebrew professor drove us crazy. The jot, vav, and the tittle, yod. Smallest letter in the Hebrew alphabet. But you put those two together, in the perfect tense, and it's called the perfect of relation. In the imperfect tense, it's called the vav consecutive. Now, what's the difference? Most of the sentences with creation are the wall consecutive. One came after another. But you get to the creation of the sun and the moon, and it shifts from the wall consecutive to the perfect of relation. Grammar, what does it mean? The translation would be, and before these things, he made the sun and the moon. Wow. Jesus does the same thing in what we call the little apocalypse in the Gospels, where he talks about the last days. And in the middle of it, he says, but before these things happen, which brings it up to the starting point. Remember that? Before these things happen? It's a Hebrew pattern of thought that is not Greek. Greek wants to do this and this and this and this. Not Hebrew. It'll do this, 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 and that. And you take the actual grammar of the Hebrew text into consideration, and it lines up with what an atheist would say about the order of creation, which to me is a pretty powerful argument for revelation. You know, it's amazing.
So, Kevin, when the King James was being translated, I assume they had all these sources in front of it. They were, a lot of them were linguists.
Yes, it was the beginning of textual criticism of Old and New Testament criticism. Remember, Martin Luther was a Hebrew scholar.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying that yet there was as much a political or theological influence in the interpretation of these as there was?
No. What I'm saying is it wasn't an issue. They didn't even think about it. Because the tradition had been, you just said, the first day, the second day, the third day. And they didn't even think about it. And to this day, I pour through the commentaries written by liberal and conservative scholars about the first chapter of Genesis, nobody talks about the numerals. Nobody talks about the verbs. And I just don't understand it. I do not. It's tradition. I'll bring it to the attention of a Hebrew professor, and he'll say, I never thought of that. Because this is what tradition is. This is what assumption is. This is what your worldview is. It is so much a part of you, you just don't even think of anything else happening, anything else being another way. So this was not a controversy. This was not an issue. Nobody was talking about it. Nobody was fighting about it. And it just slipped by. One last one.
Sure. As a Lutheran, I appreciate you being careful with the grammar text. You made the statement that Hebrew is a very regular language, but isn't it not always? And in Hebrew poetry, for example, the definite article is not so common, or the direct object marker is not so common.
You will find an occasional place in which that is the case. But in normal prose, which this would be, the exceptions are just extremely rare. And this one, in this kind of a context, I think you'd be hard put to make that argument. Well, thank you all very much. Thank you for being at our conference, and hope you enjoy the rest of it. Thank you for coming.